I'll start over. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala ashraf al-anbiya'i wa mursaleen, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi, wa man istanna bi sunnatihi ila yawmiddin. Allahumma aj'alna minhum, wa minal ladhina amanu, wa amilu salihat, wa tawassaw bil haqq, wa tawassaw bil sabr. Ameen ya Rabbil Alameen. Thumma amma ba'd, everyone, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The example of those who spend in God's cause can be considered something like a seed that gives rise to 7 ears of grain, each containing 100 seeds, that may be replanted and the process continues endlessly. Above and beyond that, Allah may multiply even further for whoever He wants and deems worthy, and His multiplication is in due proportion with His vastness, thus only He can truly know its measure, as it is beyond mortal comprehension. Such multiplication of charity for eternal reward is meant for those who, when they do give, don't ruin their charitable giving by reminding its recipients at any point thereafter of the favor you've done them, and thereby causing them pain. If you can keep yourself from ruining your good deed that way, you have no fear of the reward being nullified in the future, and you won't be standing before Allah in regret over your past errors. If you aren't able to give, a decent word and even an apology would be a better alternative than to give something and thereafter impose that favor and cause the recipient pain. Doing so will nullify your charity and renders you no different from someone who gives charity not to please Allah, but to show off to people. Clearly, such a person has no faith in Allah nor in the last day. Such people have the delusion that their charitable deeds will be rewarded in the afterlife. Imagine a boulder covered in dirt due to a landslide at the foot of a hill. It seems like fertile land, so you start growing your garden on it. You assume you've made a wise investment until heavy rain comes, washing the soil, and with it all your crop off the boulder, leaving it barren and exposed. This is to help you visualize what you will find before Allah on Judgment Day if you do so. On the contrary, those who are able to give not to show off to people, but in pursuit of seeing God's face one day. Moreover, those who give charity and remain firm thereafter, not hurting those who they gave to, expect to receive their reward much like a garden that produces beautifully, whether there is heavy rain or just drizzle, on account of the fact that it is located on higher ground in a location that is ripe for cultivation. You'll be helpless on Judgment Day, and there won't be any chance to make amends. You can secure your future now by being charitable. Think of it this way. Wouldn't every one of you love to own a garden of palm trees and grapevines, irrigated from underground, containing all manner of other fruits growing therein? Imagine the person who owns such a remarkable property and then became too old to tend to it and has children that are still too frail to carry that responsibility. And even as you might imagine, they may come up with some way of taking care of the garden. Even if barely, the garden is attacked by a brush fire and consumes all of it. This is how helpless you'll feel on Judgment Day if you ruin the garden of your charity by making the mistakes already outlined. This example is there so you may think deeply about how you are going to carry yourself. Now that you've understood why to give, in parentheses, for Allah, and how to give, in parentheses, with dignified language, learn what to give. Give out of the pure income that you earn, and out of the very best of what you've earned, and don't give things you'd be disgusted and embarrassed to receive yourself if hard times hit. You had better realize that Allah is wealthy and praiseworthy, and through His wealth, you have whatever you own, and thus you give, and you should give thus when you give, you should give praiseworthy things. That is because He gives you what inspires you to praise Him. If you were to give the very best of what you own, the devil will come to you promising you that such giving will lead you to bankruptcy. If you give into his false promise, he will gain further control over you and will indulge you in indecent acts. Thus, he will terrify you by making you think that you won't be able to fulfill your needs, and once you give into that, he will drown you in false wants. While what you actually need is forgiveness, and what you should want beyond that is Allah's favor, and both of those are what Allah is promising you instead. Allah's giving is more vast than you can perceive, and He knows it, even if you can't see it. Trust in Him and give, and don't fall for the devil's trickery. He grants the wisdom and firmness to make such mature decisions to whomsoever He wills, and if you do find yourself strong enough to heed these lessons, you should consider yourself fortunate, for whoever has been granted divine wisdom and maturity has been granted an incredibly rich good. None but the people of the soundest minds and thoughts will truly make an effort to remember this easily forgotten truth, that divine wisdom is a bigger gain than anything you lost by giving it away in charity. If you've been able to fight the devil's distractions and have given a pledge, and have given in the past or pledged to give in the future, whatever you decided to give, then Allah knows what you went through to make that commitment, and those who fall short of that commitment or invalidate their charities as previously cautioned, or don't give at all despite being able, all those wrongdoers will find no one to help them when His judgment comes. Make your charities public, well and good. But if you keep them private, especially as you give them to the needy to preserve their dignity before society, that is actually better for you. And in doing so, just as you've kept them from being exposed, Allah will bury and hide away from you some of your embarrassing sins, because only He truly knows what you've been up to. Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he's addressing the Prophet directly. If they still don't give after all this exhortation and encouragement, don't you worry, you're not in charge, you're not charged with guiding them, as that is decided by Allah for whoever He wants. Also, don't give expecting the recipients to be guided. That isn't your concern. Allah guides who He wills. In fact, when you give, it's only for yourself. And you had better not give ever, except to seek Allah's face one day, to see Allah's face one day. Know that whatever you might have spent will be given back to you by Him, so don't expect anything from people and you won't be shortchanged. You've learned now how to give, why to give, what to give. You must now learn more about who to give to. Primarily those who've been devastated by poverty because the cause of Allah led them to situations and circumstances beyond their control, and now they are destitute and incapable of conducting business as they formerly used to. Because of their dignified posture and presence, the oblivious ignoramus might assume that they are doing well and thus have no need to ask. Instead, don't be dense and recognize them by other more subtle indications. Those are not the kinds of people that are going to beg before society, letting their desperation be known by their persistent asking. Whatever good you give such people has been especially recorded by Allah. Be like those who spend night and day, that is to say secretly and openly, whatever the situation calls for, because those people will have nothing to fear for what comes ahead, and no cause for regret and grief for the sins they've left behind, as they are being wiped away with their continuous generosity. That's a flowing translation of the passage. And the point of that is to, it's not translating, it's taking the key elements of each ayah and connecting them together. Okay, so now I'm going to try to do this. This is the harder job. And if one of you can run into the office and see if they have the handouts ready, that would help. What I'd like to do now is, even if I'm not, if you don't have a visual in front of you, you can write this down and look at it for yourselves. Okay, so that'll help you. If you look at a structural overview of these ayat, what you'll notice is that the beginning and the end of these ayat have something in common. What they have in common is, in the beginning Allah said one seed will turn into 700. Remember that? And then He said those who give, they will have no fear and no grief. That was by the end. Okay? And that's in the beginning. At the end of this passage in 274, الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ بِاللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ سِرًّا وَعَلَانِيَةً فَلَهُمْ أَجْرُهُمْ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ وَلَا خَوْفٌ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا هُمْ يَحْزَنُونَ. So the fact that no fear and no grief is going to be a problem for those who truly give, it is mentioned in the beginning of this passage, and yet again at the very end of this passage, tying those two things together, the beginning of it and the end of it is a motivation of reward. And that you're doing this for yourself. You're alleviating yourself from future fear, and you're giving yourself security from grief, looking at your past, right? So that's the beginning and the end. Now we get to what lies in the middle. And what lies in the middle, interestingly, is five things, five elements, okay? And if you think of these five elements, the way I'd like to describe them is, I'll describe element number 1, 3, and 5 first. The first one, the third one, and the fifth one. So, once again, at the top and the bottom are reward. This is what you're going to get. Then in between there are five elements. And those five elements, the only ones I'm describing right now are 1, 3, and 5. Okay? That's how they're distributed. Let's see what they are. Number 1 would be show care with kind words when you give. You remember that? That would be number 1. Number 2 would be, or number 3 rather, would be show care by giving quality goods. Don't give cheap things, don't give ugly things, don't give things you wouldn't want to get yourself. And number five would be show care by giving people who don't even ask. All three of these have something in common. I put it in the first words. What are they? Show care. Be sensitive. It's actually about sensitivity in how you give and how you behave after giving, what you give, and then who you give to. Don't just give out to people who are asking, but seek out the people who don't even ask. Find out what their troubles are. تَعْرِفُهُمْ بِسِيمَاهُمْ. So it's sensitivity in 1, 3, and 5. That leaves what two items? Items number 2 and number 4. Let me tell you some things about item number 2. Item number 2, Allah gives the example of people who give to show off to people like a boulder that gets exposed. Then He gives the example of those who only want to give to make Allah happy. In other words, item number 2 is essentially rooted in one problem, that of sincerity. If you have ikhlas, your charity will count. If you don't have sincerity, it will not count. So the entire thing goes, the item number 2 is all about reward itself. Okay? Now let's look at item number 4. Shaitan promises you bankruptcy. Allah offers you forgiveness. Shaitan promises, takes you towards shamelessness. And Allah promises you benefit from him. And then he says, and you better only spend to make Allah happy. When Allah says you better only spend to make Allah happy, isn't that telling you to make your intention sincere and secure again? And isn't it also telling you to stay away from the waswasa of who? Shaitan, who will ruin your what? Intentions. Item number 2 and item number 4 are actually both addressing the matter of intentions. And securing our intentions and staying away from the element that can ruin our intentions. الشيطان يعدكم الفقر ويأمركم بالفحشاء. So if you, once again, now I've done this orally, so try to visualize it in your head. At the top and the bottom are rewards. 1, 3 and 5 are about what? Sensitivity. And then 2 and 4 interspersed in between are keep the intentions pure, keep the intentions pure, keep shaitan out of it. Right? So it's beautifully structured. It's like this remarkable building that's got these perfectly arranged elements. You know, and you can see the architecture they're in. I think it's absolutely fascinating. Now, finally, summarizing these lessons. The first question is, why should you spend? Well, here are a few simple answers to that. Well, you should spend because you'll get 700 times 700 times 700 infinitely. That's one reason. The second is no fear and no grief. لا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. The third reason is ابتغاء وجه الله. To eventually be able to face Allah. To seek the face of Allah, meaning you can stand before Allah and look at Him as He looks upon you. The second question comes, how should you spend? Here are a few key pointers. Don't remind recipients of your giving. Don't use your past giving to leverage favors. Don't make recipients feel that they are indebted to you. Don't cause hurt in any way to recipients or the cause. Don't expose recipients. It's better to remain confidential. Don't assume someone isn't in need just because they don't beg. Look for clues. This is how you give. The next question, so I've told you why you give, then how you give. And then what do you give? Give out of the best of what you earn. مِن طَيِّبَاتِ مَا كَسَبْتُمْ. You can start passing them out, inshallah. Give out of the best of what you've earned. And then don't give secondary things. Don't give rejectable things. لَا تَيَمَّمُ الْخَبِيثَ مِنْهُ. Don't intend to give filthy or unusable kinds of things. So now we've done why and how and what. And then the next question comes, who should you spend on? للفقراء. For the needy who don't even ask, who are in this state because of their commitment to the cause of Islam. Those are the people who you should give to. And finally, simply Allah put, when should you give? Laylan wa nahar. Billayli wa nahar. Sirran wa alaniya. Night and day. Give any time you can, whenever you see fit. Right? So in doing so, Allah answers every fundamental question about giving in the path of Allah. Now, I've given you this. We're going to move on, inshallah, to the next item, which is much harder. The handout's going to get passed out. I think the sisters got it. The guys didn't get it. Because we assume men don't read. So we... I'll get it to you guys, inshallah. Don't worry. But it's past the point anyway, so don't read it now. Read it later. I've already read it to you. Okay? So what I want to talk to you now about is the next subject. And there are a couple of things I want to say about that. The next subject is الَّذِينَ يَأْكُلُونَ الرِّبَى. Those who consume riba. That's the subject that's coming up, right? And these are the most exhaustive ayat in the entire Quran on the subject of riba. Those of you who are not familiar with the term, I'll introduce it inshallah in a little bit. But put it simply, it is the worst possible thing you can do with your money. To put it simply, you couldn't possibly do anything worse with your wealth than engage it in riba. That's the simple way of putting it. Now, this is placed right after the longest passage in the Quran on spending in the path of Allah. So two subjects that are dealt with in more detail like nowhere else are next to each other. Spending in the path of Allah, the longest passage we just did. And now, riba, the longest passage, is here. Right next to each other. Why? Because now that you've learned, here's the best thing you can do with your money. Spend in the path of Allah. That should be contrasted with what? What's the worst thing you can do with your money? There's a direct contrast between the two. Also understand that riba as an institution, you know, predatory loans, taking advantage of poor people, as it will describe, even the phrase will be used, in kana dhu usratin, the one who found himself in difficulty. People are starving, they don't have enough to eat, they take a loan, you know, and now you're taking advantage of that loan and charging them more back. You're feeding off of the desperation of people. When you do that, you're doing the exact opposite of the previous passage. The previous passage was help people in need. Give to them, dignify them, give them good things, be sensitive to them, show care. And now the exact opposite, you don't care if they're poor. Well, if you couldn't make the payment, now there's a late fee on top of that. And there's a penalty on top of that. This is the exact opposite. In other words, why is riba so evil? Because it's actually the Quran's exact opposite of infaq fi sabilillah. The effect of spending in the path of Allah is mercy to other human beings. The effect of riba is oppression of other human beings. You know, by means of wealth, you can show mercy to people. By means of wealth, you can oppress people. That's the contrast that's being highlighted here. I'll give it away now. The subject after this, these two subjects, the third subject, is actually going to be trade and loan agreements. In other words, the best thing you can do with your money, followed by the worst thing you can do with your money, and then the okay things to do with your money in between. That's at the end, right? So that covers the entire spectrum. I like to call this place in the Quran's comprehensive guidance on greed. Everything you need to know about dealing with greed is captured here. How do you curb your greed? By spending in the path of Allah. How do you not let your greed allow it to destroy yourself? Stay away from riba. How do you manage your greed in a healthy way? Proper business and loans. You know, that's the acceptable form of greed. Every human being at the end of the day has some greed. I do want a promotion. I do want a better, you know, salary. I do want some better furniture. That's fine. There's a limit to that. That's completely acceptable. And that's also, the range of that has been given. Now I want to share with you some, probably we'll spend most of our time today talking about this, the preliminary discussions about riba. How riba is talked about in the Quran, and its definitions in classical literature. The first thing I'd like to share with you is that the Quran never defined riba. I'll say that again. The Quran never defined riba. It mentions riba. It mentions it, never defines it. Never ever defines it. Like if you look at the question, if you ask the question, what is riba? The Quran doesn't have the answer to that question. The first problem that occurs then is, why doesn't the Quran have the answer to that question? It's clear because the Quran deals with the word riba in bilisanin arabiyyin mubin, in the clear Arabic speech. The people to whom this Quran was given already very well knew what riba is. Everybody understood the term. Just like the Quran doesn't, let's give you a silly example, but you get the point. The Quran doesn't define what the sun is. The Quran doesn't define what the earth is. It mentions the earth, but it doesn't define it. Because everybody that you're talking to already what? They already know. When the Quran doesn't define something, why doesn't it do that? It doesn't do that because the definition is already known. So among the Jewish community, the Christian community, the Mushrik community of Arabia, riba was very, very well known. It was understood. And that's what the Quran is commenting on. So in order to properly understand it, we're going to have to not only look at how Quran progressively dealt with the subject, but we're also going to have to look at how did the Arabs think about riba. We're going to have to find its definition with the Arabs, with the ancient Arabs, and see what were they doing, and then see what of that applies to us in our times. وَمَا أَتَيْتُم مِّن رِبًا لِيَرْبُوَ فِي أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ فَلَا يَرْبُوَ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. In early Meccan Quran, the first mention of riba in the Quran is in Surah Ar-Rum. Okay? And when Allah mentions this ayah, He says, whatever you give out of riba, whatever you give out of usury, then so that, and so you give it so that it will grow with people. In other words, you gave somebody a loan and you're hoping that that loan will be returned to you in 2 years. But even if you gave 1,000, you're hoping to get returned 1,500. You're hoping to, that it grows among people and then it comes back to you bigger than you gave. Right? Then he says, فَلَا يَرْبُوا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ, no one thing, it will not grow with Allah. In other words, that growth is not blessed by Allah. And in the Akhirah, it won't be counted as growth. If you think you did somebody a favor, okay, I gave them a loan, and a loan generally you would think you did somebody a favor. But if you were hoping that it will grow with them, and then you'll get better money back, then no one thing, don't expect Allah to reward you for doing that. In saying that, Allah did not make riba haram. He just said, don't expect anything in the Akhirah. That's all He said. He didn't say much more than that. So in the earliest revelation about riba, there isn't actually a clear, explicit kind of prohibition. Ibn Jarir al-Tabari from Ibn Abbas radiallahu ta'ala anhuma narrates something, and I'd like to share that with you. And there are others, Ibrahim al-Nakhi'i, Qatada, Dhahhak, others have mentioned this too. That riba in this verse isn't like loans and interest payback, but actually riba has another meaning too. Sometimes you give somebody a gift. Right? You went to somebody's house and you gave them a gift. And in your head, you're hoping that when they come over to your house, they get you a nicer gift. Right? So, that's actually one of the old meanings of riba too. Like an unspoken expectation that you're going to get something more back. So, وَمَا أَتَيْتُم مِن رِبًا and then لِيَرْبُوَ فِي أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ is actually kind of like, and so they said this is not explicitly talking about it, but most said no, Quran used the word riba as in the business practice of riba, so we're going to stick with that definition. Anyway, the second mention of riba comes in Surah An-Nisa. Chronologically speaking, it comes in Surah An-Nisa. There's actually, Justice Taqi Uthmani wrote a really comprehensive paper on riba, because in the Pakistan court system, there was a debate about modern banking, is it riba or not? Right? And it was taken into the appeals court or whatever, and Pakistan still has, I don't know how much influence it has, but it has a Sharia court. Right? So they have a Supreme Court, and they have other court system, but they also have a Sharia court. And one of the Supreme Court judges, or Sharia court judges, is Justice Safi Osmani, and he was given this case. Because they argued, well, riba of that time is not riba of the banking of the current economic system or whatever. So he wrote a court paper before he issued his verdict. And that court paper is actually, because the official language is English, in the courts, it's actually an English paper. And much of what I'm giving to you is actually from his paper. It's very comprehensive, it's accessible online, and I will probably put a link to that in the handouts the next time I send them to you, inshallah. Just to let you guys know where you can access it. But this is kind of somewhat of an abstract from that paper. Okay? A really very comprehensive document. Anyhow, the second mention is Surah An-Nisa. Surah An-Nisa, arguably, is definitely before the fourth year of Medina. So the Prophet has moved to Medina, it's definitely before the fourth year. Why do we know that for sure? Not because the Prophet said it that way, or there are athar, but there are other indications. The other indications are, this passage from Surah An-Nisa begins, يَسْأَلُكَ أَهْلُ الْكِتَابِ أَن تُنَزِّلَ عَلَيْهِمْ كِتَابًا مِّنَ السَّمَاءِ فَقَدْ سَأَلُوا مُوسَىٰ أَكْبَرَ مِنْ ذَلِكَ. The people of the book ask you that you should send them a law, a constitution, a legal framework, like the one Musa was given. And so Allah says, oh, these Jews are coming and asking you to give you a law like the law of Moses. Well, they asked Musa even more. They weren't even happy with what Moses gave them. So what are you talking about? And then Allah makes a list of the things they asked Musa, calling them out. قَالُوا أَرِنَ اللَّهَ جَهْرَةً. Show us Allah face to face. بِمَا نَقْضِهِمْ مِثَاقَهُمْ. They violated their covenant. قَتْلِهِمُ الْأَنْبِيَاءِ بِغَيْرِ حَقٍ. They killed their prophets. قَوْلِهِمْ قُلُوبُنَا غُلْفٍ. They said, our hearts are locked up. كُفْرِهِمْ وَبِكُفْرِهِمْ. They disbelieved. وَقَوْلِهِمْ عَلَى مَرْيَمْ بُهْتَانًا عَظِيمًا. They made slander against Maryam salamun alayha. وَقَوْلِهِمْ إِنَّا قَتَلْنَا الْمَسِيحَ عِيسَى ابْنَ مَرْيَمَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ. And they're boasting that we killed Jesus, the son of Mary. Ha! He used to think he's a messenger of Allah. We killed him. What kind of messenger gets killed? They boasted about it. وَبِصَدِّهِمْ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. Later on, they stopped others from the path of Allah. وَأَخْذِهِمُ الرِّبَى. And their taking of riba. Here are the crimes you committed. And among the crimes of the Jews, they took riba. Now I said, this was before what year? the fourth year. The reason I say that is because by the fourth year, because of the events that transpired in the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ, the Jews were expelled from Medina. And this conversation clearly is happening with the Jews that are asking these questions of the Prophet ﷺ. So it's happening before the events, you know, that transpire later on. So it's happening when they're still there and they're asking these questions. Now, here Allah says, وَأَخْذِهِمُ الرِّبَى وَقَدْ نُهُوا عَنْهُ. And they're taking of riba even though they were prohibited from taking riba. This ayah clearly states that Torah also mentioned that riba is haram. And they were told not to do it. Jews, listen to this carefully, Jews were told not to take riba. Explicitly in the Torah. But that still doesn't say Quran is saying that. It just says that Torah is saying that. But by implication you can argue, well, the Quran would never condemn them for not doing something if the Muslims themselves weren't expected to live by it also. So you can't say that explicitly this is the evidence that riba is haram, but you can say in the spirit of إِلِمَا تَقُولُونَ مَا لَا تَفْعَلُونَ, in the spirit of telling something, أَتَأْمُرُونَ النَّاسَ بِالْبِرِّ وَتَنْسَوْنَ أَنفُسَكُمْ, you tell people, you criticize them for the good they don't do, and you're going to forget about yourselves. By implication, it could mean that Muslims should stay away from riba, but not directly. Now we get to the third, which is actually even a little earlier than that. This is one of the most explicit prohibitions of riba in the Quran. This is in Ali Imran. Ali Imran, this ayah could be very well argued because of several narrations, is before the second year of Hijrah. So the Prophet has moved to Medina, and it's been less than 2 years, or 2 years approximately, when this ayah comes. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu la ta'kulu riba adhafan mudha'afa. Those of you who believe, don't consume riba. Don't consume usury or interest that multiplies on itself, that keeps on multiplying and enhancing on its own. Okay? And the context of it, like is mentioned, is the Battle of Uhud. So there's a couple of interesting things here. Some Sahaba noticed that the enemies of Islam that are preparing for the second great fight, Badr was the first great fight, Uhud is the second great fight. The Quraysh want to be more prepared because they clearly underestimated the enemy. So they're going to build a bigger army, spend more money to build the army, to fight the Muslims this time than they came with the first time. In order to do that, they need more finances. And in order to build that bigger army, they started taking loans. The Mushrikun of Arabia, the Quraysh, started taking loans to finance a bigger army. Sound familiar? But anyway, so when they did that, the Muslims saw this and said, well, they're taking loans and they're amassing their army. We are now an established society. Maybe we can reach some other tribes and take some loans with them and amass our army. But the standard was what? When you take a loan, you are going to be paying back with what? With riba, with interest. You're going to pay back more than you took. So they said, well, we got to fight fire with fire. You know, if they're doing it, we got to do it. And that in that context, Allah said, لا تأكلوا الربا أضعف مضاعفا. Don't consume riba that builds on itself. Do not do this. And this is an interesting indication that not only is the Quran prohibiting and condemning making money from riba, but is also condemning borrowing of riba. Because, you know, one argument that's you know, furthered is that riba is an act of oppression against the poor. And the poor don't have a choice, they have to, because if they didn't pay it, they would have nothing. So you should condemn the lender, but you shouldn't necessarily condemn the borrower. Though in some cases that is true. If a borrower is absolutely in destitute situation, didn't have any choice but to take a loan or whatever happened, and it was a predatory loan, disadvantages to themselves, maybe in those cases you can argue that they are not to be condemned. But in this ayah, they thought, well, we should compete with the enemy, and we should be up to date with the times. This is not because we're dying of starvation. This is because we want to just fight fire with fire, and therefore we should take riba. That was also called aklur riba. That's an important consideration. So it's not just about making profiteering, like the bank isn't criticized only, the borrower is also being criticized now. That's very clear because of the sabab of this ayah. There's another interesting indication that this is even before the Battle of Uhud began. Abu Dawud mentions this in his Sunan, narrated by Abu Huraira, that it was a man named Amr ibn Aqyash. He was a pretty wealthy guy, and he used to give loans. And obviously the reason he gave loans is not because he was generous. He gave loans because he used to get money back on interest. And this was the way he made money. He was not Muslim, and he wanted to accept Islam. And he delayed accepting Islam. He was reluctant to accept Islam because he knew that once he accepts Islam, he cannot make money off of interest anymore. That was his only reason to not accept Islam. And then finally, Uhud happens. The enemy is coming. And he says, I'm not going to delay anymore. He joins the battle of Uhud and he died a shaheed. Okay? Now what that tells you is that the prohibition of riba had already come before Uhud. Because he is reluctant to join Islam because of riba. Clearly the prohibition already exists and that's why he is reluctant. Okay. Now this is the last and final mention of riba in the Quran, the one that we're going to be dealing with. This is ayah number 275 all the way to 281. These long ayat of the Quran are the final verdict of riba. About them, there's a lot that's been said. Some also say that these are some of the last ayat revealed. Actually, there are a couple of narrations of the Prophet ﷺ, about the Prophet ﷺ by a number of sahaba who say the last ayahs that were revealed were the ayat about riba. Okay? So this is basically past Fath Makkah and finishing touches on the Sharia, and then these ayat of riba came. Some people have incorrectly derived from that riba became haram all the way at the end of the seerah. Because the ayat of riba, final ayat of riba came at the end of the seerah. What I've tried, the reason I gave you that chronology, most importantly is to illustrate by the time Uhud came around, it was already explicitly known that riba is prohibited. So the argument that riba only became prohibited way, way, way at the end is actually a false argument. There's plenty of evidence against that claim. Okay? Also, the Prophet ﷺ did something interesting. And some people say that because Rasulullah ﷺ, when he came to address the people in, you know, the Hujjat al-Wida, and when he gave the address, his uncle, Abbas, who was a wealthy man in Makkah, and he used to give a lot of loans. He used to lend people a lot of money. But because of Islam, and he became Muslim in the 8th year. Okay? And when he comes back to Makkah, this is his chance to basically collect on his loans. So the Prophet makes an announcement that even my uncle will not collect anything except the principal. He will not collect any interest. People look at that narration and say, well, that means it is at that time that the Prophet prohibited interest. No, it is at that time that he had the largest gathering so he can remind them about, and he reminded them about everything, about stealing, about alcohol, about, and he mentioned a bunch of things, including no more riba. And anybody who's given any loans, anybody who's advanced any loans, well, you can't take them back with interest. That is no longer allowed. That was announced at Fath Makkah so that it's a public service announcement for the education of the Muslim community. That's actually what's going on there, okay? Now, I want to share some things with you from the Bible, because I did mention the Torah, you know, prohibited riba. So even in the Hebrew Bible as we have it now, the Old Testament, there are a few. By the way, the Jews don't like calling it Old Testament because that makes them sound like it's expired and stuff. So, because the Christians use that because they got the New Testament. You know, so the more respectful term for them is the Hebrew Bible, which is fine. Okay? So here's from Deuteronomy 23:19: Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, mistletoes, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. That's the first. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in the holy hill? He that walketh upon rightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart, he that putteth not out of his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. This is in Psalms. The next one in Proverbs. He that by usury and unjust gain increases his substance, he shall gather it for him that will pity the poor. Then in Nehemiah, when I consulted with myself and I rebuked the nobles and rules and said unto them, you exact usury, every one of his brother, and yet I set great assembly against them. He hath, and this is in Ezekiel, he that had not given forth upon usury, neither had taken any increase, and had withdrawn his hand from iniquity, hath executed true judgment between man and man, hath walked in my statutes, and hath kept upon my judgment to deal truly, he is just. Meaning, if you don't give usury or take usury, then you are just. That's what the Bible is saying. In thee have they taken gifts to shed blood. Thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbor by exhortation, and hast forgotten me. Meaning taking riba is forgetting Allah in the Torah. Taking riba is forgetting Allah, right? In these excerpts of the Bible, the word usury is used in the sense of any amount claimed by the creditor over and above the principal advanced by the debtor. I'll explain that after salah some more. The word riba used in the Quran carries the same meaning because the ayat of Surah An-Nisa that mentions the Jews says أَخْذِهِمُ riba without defining it. So when the Jews heard أَخْذِهِمُ riba, what were they thinking about? Riba as it's talked about in Torah. And Torah is mentioning usury over and over again. So the practice of giving somebody something and expecting more in return, that is the practice of usury. Inshallah, from here, we'll go to some of the Aqwal al-Fuqaha on the definition of riba as the Arabs back in the day understood it. So we'll stop here. Barakallahu li wa lakum fil Qur'an al-Hakim. Wa nafa'ani wa iyaakum bil ayat wa dhikr al-Hakim.